Welcome back to the program. 49 years ago last week, John F. Kennedy's assassination brought the end of Camelot. Yet the Kennedy legacy and even the Kennedy dynasty still continued. A political dynasty that was, at its core, the dream of one man, Joseph P. Kennedy, the father of Jack and Bobby and Teddy. Joseph Kennedy was a kind of Zelig-like character whose impact was part of almost every major event in the first half of the 20th century. To the extent that the Kennedys have had a profound impact on this nation, then there's no question that Joseph Kennedy was the progenitor of that impact, and it's worth taking a look at his remarkable and complex life. That's the subject of a new book by my guest David Nassau. David Nassau is the author of previous biographies of Andrew Carnegie and William Randolph Hearst. He is a preeminent historian as well as the Arthur M. Schlesinger Jr. Professor of History at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. It is my pleasure to welcome David Nassau here to talk about his new work, The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy. David Nassau, thanks so much for joining us.
Delighted to be with you.
Great to have you here. One of the things that is so remarkable in looking at the totality of Joseph Kennedy's life is, as you talk about, the degree to which he touched so many aspects of life, particularly in the first half of the 20th century, there was almost nothing that he wasn't involved in.
No, exactly. I'm a historian first, and I'm a historian who writes biographies. And as a historian, this is a life that carries the reader, and certainly carried me as the researcher and writer, through the 20th century. I mean, he's born in 1888. He, during World War II, serves on the home front in a shipbuilding plant in Boston, and then goes into Wall Street and brokerage during the heydays of the 1920s, is in Hollywood from the transition from the silence to the talkies, the most important moment in the Hollywood history, goes back to the East Coast and is a campaign manager and a campaigner for Franklin Roosevelt, goes to Washington and is a major factor in the New Deal as the first chairman of the SEC and then of the Maritime Commission, is in London for the run-up to World War II and for the Battle of Britain, for the Blitz, comes back to the United States, lives through a war vicariously and frighteningly through his sons, is a major spokesperson for an alternative point of view during the Cold War, and advises his son through successful campaigns for the Congress from 1946 to 1952, then for the Senate in 52 and 58, and the presidency in 60. So here's a man who spans American life in the 20th century, from the Great War to the New Frontier.
And yet, as much as he shaped and influenced so many aspects of life in the country during that period, he constantly went back and forth between seeing himself as both an insider, which he was on so many occasions, and also this role that he really seemed to like as an outsider.
Yeah, it's, you know, it. When you begin a biography, you don't know what it's about. You know it's about an individual, clearly, but you don't know what the storyline is going to be, what the plot is going to be. And it must have been a couple of years through this, or into the research and the writing, I discovered that plot. I discovered that I did not know enough about ethnic politics and about the divisions in this country. You know, we talk about the divisions between red states and blue states today, and they shape politics. But the divisions between, I can only call them, ethnic or religious tribes through the 20th century was a defining mark of American culture, politics, and society. I mean, Joe Kennedy was defined by the rest of the world as an Irish Catholic first, which angered him tremendously. He would say over and over again, "My parents were born in the United States. I was born in the United States. I've never been in Ireland. You know, my grandparents came over to this country when they were young people. I'm an American." And yet people would continue to talk about him as if he was this exotic breed. He was an outsider, and he discovered that in a frightening way when he graduated from Harvard and wanted to go into banking or finance and couldn't get a job. And the only reason, because again, he had a Harvard education, was good with numbers, was good with people, was that he was an Irish Catholic in a business that was run by and for Boston Brahmins.
And yet when he went out to Hollywood, he took that outsider status and turned it to his advantage.
It's a remarkable story. When he comes to Hollywood, he remakes himself as the Boston banker who is the non-Jew. No longer is he the outsider as the Catholic. Now he makes himself, from the outsider, the non-Jew in Hollywood. He makes that a virtue. And he says to the studio heads, and they listen, your major problem is that the country sees this industry as controlled by aliens, by Eastern European Jews. And he said, if you don't do something about it, your product is going to be banned or censored by in cities and towns and states across the country because they're worried about a Jewish product reaching their children unmediated. So I'll save the industry. I'm, you know, the Yankee who's come to save the industry. And he positioned himself in such a way and rose from the owner of a minor little studio to control of the major studios in Hollywood, one after the other.
How much of this came from savvy business judgment, or how much of it came from his latent, and later on in his life, less latent anti-Semitism?
I think it's both. I think as an Irish Catholic, he looks at the world in terms of ethnic politics. You know, what tribe do you belong to? Are you, and I mean, and this is how he grew up in Boston. Are you Italian? Are you Jewish? Are you Irish Catholic? And in the beginning, when he goes to Hollywood, he writes back admiringly of the Jews. He says they really know how to stick together and they know how to take care of each other. And Rose, his wife, always believes that part of his sense of how important family is comes from his days in Hollywood, observing Jewish families and the Jewish community. It is during World War II that this admiration for the other, you know, the other community, the other tribe, turns sharply into distrust, anger. He is, I'm skipping here, I hope that's okay.
It's okay, go ahead.
He is convinced that it is in the best interest of the United States to stay out of any entanglement in European affairs. Any. That means we shouldn't supply the British in their fight against the Germans, and we certainly shouldn't enter the war against the Germans.
But part of that was also because he thought the Germans were going to win. I mean, he had this really deep-seated pessimism about how it was going to turn out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what happens is that he is so convinced that he's right, that when the rest of the world, when Washington disagrees with him, when Roosevelt says, we got to supply the British so that they can fight over there and we don't have to fight over here against this German behemoth, he begins to look around and to say, why doesn't anybody get it? And the answer is he scapegoats the Jews. He falls back on the oldest myth, one of the oldest myths in Western civilization, that the Jews are this sinister element who care only for themselves and who he believes are willing to sacrifice American lives and American prosperity to get back at Hitler, that there's a Jewish conspiracy, that the Jews control the media, that the Jews exercise an inordinate power in Washington, in the New Deal, over Roosevelt, and that they don't care what's good for the country. They care only what's good for the Jews, and they think that is to go to war against Hitler.
To the extent that this became something that really caused him to be thrown out of Great Britain as the ambassador there and put him in some disrepute after he came back to the U.S., how did he begin to recover from that?
It's one of the more extraordinary parts of this life history. He comes back to the United States in disgrace in 1940. He endorses Roosevelt for a third term in 1940, and then goes on this speaking tour against American involvement in the war. He gives an interview in Boston, which is syndicated and blasted all across the country, in which the former ambassador says literally, England's finished. It's wiped up. It's gone. Democracy's over in Britain. There's no way they're going to win the war. Every dollar we give them is a dollar wasted, which doesn't make very many people happy in the United States, except maybe some German Americans. Then he goes out to Hollywood, and he gives presents a three-hour diatribe at a meeting held by Jack Warner at the Warner Studios to mostly Jewish Hollywood executives. And he says over and over again, you guys better stop the anti-Hitler, anti-Nazi propaganda. Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator had just come out. He said, because you're going to push this nation into war. You're going to make the American people hate the Germans. The result is going to be war. The result is going to be the loss of American lives and the worst outbreak of anti-Semitism in this country that you've ever seen. And you'll be responsible unless you stop this propaganda. It's a frightening, outrageous display. And Kennedy becomes known in Washington, in Hollywood, in New York, as this renegade, this madman who thinks nothing but keeping the United States out of a war that most Americans are beginning to believe we have to fight. What he then lays low for a little bit of time, when his son enters politics in 1946, Kennedy decides that he's going to stop talking because he doesn't want any media interest or focus to be on him. But he can't help himself. And during the 50s, the late 40s and the 50s, he becomes again a spokesperson, an advocate of appeasement and isolation. But this time around, he's against the Cold War. He's against NATO. He's against sending American boys to Korea. He's against the Americans giving aid to the French in Indochina. He's against supporting the nationalist Chinese. He's against the Marshall Plan. You name it, he's against it.
Do you think that to a certain extent, the degree to which he continued to be such a hardcore isolationist in the Cold War in some ways tempered the anti-Semitism because it showed an overarching, some would say craziness, or an overarching philosophy that seemed to transcend his attitudes towards the Jews?
I think that's very interesting. Very interesting. And I think, in a sense, he's not an anti-Semite in the way Henry Ford or Charles Lindbergh are anti-Semites. He doesn't believe that there's something intrinsic in, the genetic makeup or the bloodstream that makes Jews sinister and evil. He believes that the Jews, like the Irish Catholics, look after their own first, and that's why they can't be trusted. During the 1950s, he doesn't pay attention anymore to the Jewish question. He doesn't go after organized Jewry in the same extent that he had before. And I think his consistency as an appeaser, he's clear. He has another vision of the United States, and that's a vision of a country that takes care of its own, that defends its borders, that defends the Western Hemisphere, that focuses its energies and trade on Latin America rather than on Europe and on Asia, and that every dollar we spend fighting a Cold War is a dollar lost, that if we let the Russians alone, if we let the Soviet Union alone, eventually it's going to fall apart. And he believed the same with Germany. He was willing to sacrifice a generation of not only Jews, but of Europeans to Nazi tyranny to keep the United States out, because he believed that Nazi tyranny would not last forever and would not reach these shores.
How did these views square with his Catholicism and, more importantly, his overall relationship with the Catholic Church?
That's a fascinating question. I think that he, as a man of peace and as a man opposed to war and as a man who believes in negotiation, and as a man who distrusts, you know, the Jewish community, is very much part of the Catholic, is very much a Catholic and an Irish Catholic. He comes into opposition with the Catholic Church only during the 50s, when the Vatican turns much more anti-communist than he wants it to be, and when the Catholic Church begins to take a hard line against the Soviet Union, when he believes negotiations are possible. But up until then, the views of Joseph P. Kennedy and the Vatican do not radically diverge.
Did he have a relationship? Was there a relationship with Pope Pius during the war?
Yeah. He knows Pope Pius from earlier days, when the Pope had been the Secretary of State to the Vatican. He admires him. He reveres him. He believes he's a man of peace. He does not subscribe to any of the views that are now current, that Pope Pius could have done more to protect the Jews and could have done more, could have spoken out earlier and more strongly against Nazi depredations. But, you know, the Vatican as an institution believes it's not only an institution, it's a nation. And it follows its own foreign policy. And Kennedy supported that.
I want to talk a little bit about his vision for his kids and his sense that he had early on of wanting them to be involved in public service, to the point where when he set out to make his fortune, it was in part so that he would leave $1 million to each of his kids.
Yeah, isn't that remarkable? His goal, and he said it many times, was to make enough money so that he could leave each of his 9 children with a $1 million trust fund. And he accomplished this. He didn't want his children to have to earn money, to have to make money. He wanted to leave them enough so that they could give something back to this nation so that they could go into public service. Now, he did that because, again, as the insider-outsider, he wanted his children to be part of, he wanted his children to be the ultimate insiders, to be part of the American establishment. And the way to do that, he thought, was through public service and through government. So from their earliest days, they knew that they were pointed, and they accepted the direction he pointed them in. They knew that they were pointed towards public service, towards politics.
Talk a little bit about his relationship with his kids and with the family. Although he was always on the go, he managed to keep this relationship going in large part through letters that he would write to them.
He would write when he was away from the family. Certainly when he was in London and the family had been evacuated back to the United States during the Battle of Britain, he kept in touch with his kids. He would call every Sunday, and he would speak to each of them. He would write each child a separate letter, 9 separate letters. He knew and watched over each child's growing up, their health problems, their education. He knew who their teachers were. He knew who their best friends were. He knew whether they were getting along with their brothers and sisters or not. He knew about their exploits on the ball fields or sailing. He had a personal relationship, and they all believed that. They all thought that they were the most special child. He made them feel better. He instilled confidence into these kids. That was very important later on.
He looked at the family like a business in many ways.
Yeah, he looked at the family. He wanted each kid. He wanted each kid to succeed. But what's remarkable to me was that he raised kids who were independent-minded and strong-willed, and he understood that. I'll give you one example. He was violently opposed to World War II, but his boys wanted to fight for their country, even though it was a war their father opposed. And not only did they want to fight, but they wanted to take up the most dangerous occupations in the war. Joe Jr. wanted to fly bombers. Jack wanted to serve as a PT boat commander. Bobby, who was 16, wanted to forego college and go directly into the Navy. And their father, knowing that once they made up their minds, they were going to move ahead, did everything he could to help them along. He made the contacts with them. He helped them get into officers' candidate school. He arranged for Bobby to graduate early from high school so he could go into the Navy, even though he was absolutely opposed to the war and to their fighting in it. He found all his kids' jobs, their first jobs, and counseled them and helped them find where they were going. He, when they brought home girls or boys and said, "This is my future spouse," he welcomed them into the family. They always knew that they had a supporter, an advocate, a fan, a man who believed in them. In their father.
How much more difficult was it for you as a biographer and as a historian dealing with somebody whose life has connections still to living people today?
Boy, that's another great, great question. I don't like to write about living people. I don't like to do oral histories. I would much rather read letters than to talk to someone, because it's easier for me to evaluate the veracity of what's written down than to listen to someone tell me persuasively something that might not be true, and to try to figure out what's true, what's false, what a person knows or thinks that person knows. I also admired very much the people I met. I admired. Ted Kennedy, I spent time with him. He's was a remarkable man. Eunice and Jean and the grandchildren, I liked them all. And, you know, there was a part of me that didn't want to write some of the stuff I had to write about their father and grandfather. But my job, I don't write for the family. I don't write for the subject of my biography. You know, I write for my readers. And I owe them the truth as I see it, as I find it. I owe my subject, I'm obligated to them to be as generous I can in understanding the way their minds work and why they do what they do. But my greatest responsibility is to my readers. So in the end, I wrote some stuff that I didn't think the family, the living family, would be happy with.
Talk finally about the irony of this guy, Joseph Kennedy, who devoted so much of his life, his career, his effort to the family, what he wanted to accomplish for the family, the irony of him then outliving 5 of his 9 children.
It was tragic. It was absolutely tragic. I mean, here is a man who loses 2 children in their 20s. His son, Joe Jr., and Kick, mm-hmm. his daughter, his favorite daughter, who before that had lost her husband to the war. And then he loses a 3rd child to a horribly botched lobotomy. He had been told by the best experts in the world that Rosemary would accept her condition, would not be depressed or anxious with the lobotomy. Instead, she was turned into a vegetable, unable to communicate. And she was taken from the family. That's 3. And then, after he has a debilitating stroke, which renders him incapable of using language, he is told that first Jack, and then only a few years later, Bobby, have been killed by assassins' bullets in the most brutal way. When he dies, there are 4 children to mourn him. And Rosemary, who is left with the intelligence of a 2 or 3-year-old. So the man who gave everything for his family sees half of that family die violent deaths before he does.
David Nassau, the book is The Patriarch, The Remarkable Life and Turbulent Times of Joseph P. Kennedy. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you.